Dr. John B. Cobb Jr. is the founding co-director of the Center for Process Studies. He's professor emeritus at Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. He has published over 300 articles at last count, over 30 books, and he has edited 10 books. Recent titles include The Process Perspective, Transforming Christianity in the World, A Way Between Absolutism and Relativism, The Earthist Challenge to Economism, and my very favorite title, Postmodernism and Public Policy, Reframing Religion, Culture, Education, Sexuality, Class, Race, Politics, and the Economy. John Cobb will speak to us today on the topic Process Theology, an Introductory Introduction. Will you welcome John Cobb?
Thank you. We had an email all the way from New Zealand complaining about the title. So maybe I should say a word about that, superfluous word, which nevertheless might not be altogether superfluous. That is the first introductory. We planned some years ago that at the beginning of each semester, we would give an introductory lecture, hoping that some of the new students coming to the school and others would want to know something about what this process theology is that has played an important role in the life of this community over the years. The problem has been we don't want to just say the same thing every semester, and so we've spoken on quite a variety of different topics in quite a number of angles, and I'm not sure that very often we have really introduced process theology as such in these lectures. So I decided this time I would really try to introduce process theology. Now, of course, one problem is I see a good many familiar faces here, and you already have been introduced to process theology. But you'll have to hear it all over again. And for those of you who have not previously encountered it, I hope this will make some sense, not be difficult. On the other hand, to introduce it in 50 minutes means we'll have to cover several topics rather rapidly, and that may be a little difficult to assimilate at that speed. Now, one of the reasons that a truly introductory introduction to process theology is difficult is that process theology is a philosophical theology. Now, there's nothing unusual about a philosophical theology. If you just look through all the centuries of Christian theology, most theologies have been philosophical theologies. But the problem for introducing a philosophical theology in 50 minutes is that you can't really understand it without understanding the philosophy that is being made use of for the purposes of theology. For many centuries, it was assumed that philosophy was the handmaid of theology. And the handmaid played a very considerable role in shaping the way in which theology was formulated and the decisions that were made about it. And it's really not possible to seriously introduce a philosophy in just a few minutes. And the problem is that the questions philosophers answer are not the questions that most people immediately ask. It's possible in a philosophy class, and many of you have had this experience, I'm sure, to work with students and help them see that there is a problem or a question to be asked, and then to indicate what the philosophical answers from the various traditions have been. But the questions most of us ask most of the time must be deepened or radicalized in order to really become clearly philosophical questions. Well, if I can't engage in an introduction or an introductory introduction to process theology that way, then we have to look for another way to do it. And the other way of doing it has also been followed a lot in the history of Christian theology, especially beginning with the Reformation. And this is to try to develop theology much more directly from the biblical text without making explicit use of philosophy. So we call this, or we can call this, biblical theology. Or you can find something similar to that in the confessional theologies of the various denominations. I'm a Methodist, and we can turn to Wesley. And Wesley was immersed in the Bible. I don't think you can read his writings without being struck by the fact that about 50% of the words in his sermons are taken directly from biblical texts. He uses the language of the Bible pervasively in his formulations. And I think we can read Wesley with understanding without knowing much about philosophy, though Wesley himself had some philosophical interests, and they did influence him. They are not the primary matter. So today I'm going to be presenting process theology in relationship to biblical thought, with making very little explicit reference to philosophy. Now, of course, what I see in the Bible is influenced by my philosophical ideas. There's no question about that. That's true of everybody who does biblical theology. They bring their own eyes, and their own eyes are shaped by the history in which they live. And this is the relativity in which we all inevitably exist. But that doesn't mean we have to elaborate the philosophical conceptuality behind the perspective that we bring in order to talk intelligibly. Now, the second decision that I've made is to focus on theology. And we could say theology in the narrow sense, because we use theology to refer to a lot of things. And in the past two centuries, a great deal of theology has talked much more about human beings and human history and religious experience than about God. Process theology calls itself, or at least in the Charles Hartshorne called it, neoclassical theology. And that's because for classical theology, a wrestling with what God is, or who God is, what the characteristics of God are, and so forth, was at the very center. And he wanted to make a proposal that he thought was both philosophically better and more appropriate to the Bible than the orthodox traditions that were developed in the ancient and medieval churches, and to a large extent have continued on to the present. So I'm going to pick up on that program, especially in terms of the biblical side of it. That doesn't mean we're going to be doing close biblical study. I'll make sweeping generalizations, and you will probably, in many cases, find some fault with them. That's fine, but we'll get a discussion off the ground that way. Okay. Now, one of the features of classical theology that many Christians have either ignored or denied, I think ignoring is much more common than denying, is that God is totally immutable. Now, immutable means does not change in any respect. Now, if God does not change in any respect, then what happens in the world seems not to make any difference to God. And practically speaking, most Christians don't think that way. I mean, one of the most common Christian activities is prayer. Now, this might be simply a prayer of praise or thanksgiving. And one might say, well, it doesn't make any difference whether it affects God. But on the other hand, it seems a bit odd that we spend so much time expressing gratitude to God and praising God if we don't think it makes any difference to God at all, whether we do that or not. So some minimal sense that God is pleased by our gratitude, I believe, is a kind of deep common sense among pious Christians. And that contradicts the strict notion that God is immutable. The challenge is even sharper when we engage in petitionary prayer or intercessory prayer. I think the most common form of prayer, especially when we ask a group, for anyone who wishes to raise a concern and put it in the form of prayer, is probably an intercessory prayer for someone who is ill. We are asked to pray for the ill. Well, then the question is, does our praying for the person who is sick make any difference whatsoever to God? Well, you see, it might be that it only changes us. Or maybe we think that there are some kinds of connections between us and the person who is ill so that this activity of praying for the other person is going to have some effect. But the form of prayer suggests that we really think it makes some difference to God, that we will have some effect on God, and God will have some effect upon the sick person. Well, all of that is contradictory to the doctrine of divine immutability. So what I'm trying to say is there has been, through many, many centuries in the life of the church, a tension between the official theological doctrine of God's total immutability and the practice of the church, what actually goes on in the liturgy, the kinds of expressions that we engage in when we worship together, and much of the practical piety that we may have in a more individual way. Process theologians are not at all the first ones to point this out and to raise questions about the doctrine of divine immutability. Many others have done so. In fact, so many have done so that today it may be harder to persuade people that the church teaches divine immutability than it is to argue for an alternative view. Nevertheless, the idea is there deeply in the tradition, and it does show up in some of our hymnody and some of our prayers and so forth and so on. I think it's important to mention it, and you can imagine that a process theology is not going to affirm that God is immutable. What is the alternative? Well, we need to ask, why did we ever come to the doctrine of divine immutability? Some people say, well, it's a biblical doctrine. It is not a biblical doctrine. There are a few places in which in the Bible it speaks of God not changing. But in the context, it's quite clear that what does not change is God's commitment to fulfill God's promises. Or it's God's character of concern for the people of Israel. We can count on God not to be fickle. That's what the Bible is saying. But to say that not being fickle means you are not affected by anything that happens in the world is a huge leap. And it's a leap that hardly makes sense. Well, because this is so obviously a problematic point, let me just mention the major way in which, in the tradition, it's been dealt with. Very few Christians want to say that God is ignorant of what happens in the world. But then you would seem that when something new happens in the world, God now knows something that God did not know the moment before. That would be a change in God. So if God is immutable, the argument is, for us, events happen sequentially, but for God, everything happens all at once. So in order to save the doctrine of divine immutability, much of the classical tradition has affirmed that for God, time is not real. Now, in my judgment, if you say for God, time is not real, then time is not real. So that we all live in a context of extreme, not falsehood exactly, but extreme misimpression, illusion. We often object to the fact that in Hinduism, we are taught that this phenomenal world of flux is an illusion. But according to the classical Christian doctrine, Christianity teaches the same thing. But I don't think you can find anything remotely like that in the Bible. So it seems to me if we have that much difference between our official theology and the Bible, we should at least raise the question, maybe we should develop our theology from the Bible, rather than from a particular set of philosophically influenced ideas. Now, it's not just a philosophical influence. It's also a matter of deep-seated values. If we read a lot of the Greek thought of the classical period of Greece, we will find that over and over again, the ideal of the good turns out to be an ideal of invulnerability. That is, what makes a human being well off? Not all the Greeks would take this line, but many did. The Stoics and the Epicureans, for example, both which were very important in the days of the New Testament and the centuries immediately after that, both of them taught that what we want to do is to live in such a way that nothing that anyone else does can hurt us. Now, as long as you care what other people think about you, obviously, you are extremely vulnerable. So one of the most important things is not to care about what other people think about you. And, of course, as long as you care about having the good things of life, you're extremely vulnerable because they may be taken away from you. As long as it makes a real difference to you whether you're in jail or outside of jail, you're very vulnerable. So you have to cultivate a mindset that dismisses everything like that from importance. Socrates emphasized that the one thing people could not, no one could take away from you would be your own virtue. So I do not mean to depict this as a mean-spirited or nasty view, but it's different from the biblical one. If you contrast the ideal of invulnerability, which gives rise to the notion of immutability and the classical doctrine of God, with the doctrine of love, then you see that the person who loves is never invulnerable. If you love another person, that means that that person's suffering is going to disturb you. So, the difference is between taking invulnerability and absolutizing it and attributing it to God as one of the divine perfections, and taking love and attributing that to God as one of the divine perfections. If we follow the biblical course and say God's perfection is found in the perfection of divine love, then instead of saying God is invulnerable, we would say God is perfectly vulnerable. Everything that anyone feels, God feels to you. God suffers with us in our suffering and rejoices with us in our rejoicing. Because that's what love does. Now, 50 years ago, when I was a student, that right? Maybe no, I was already out of being a student. Anyway, long time ago, the idea that God suffered was viewed askance and regarded as rather heretical by most people in the theological community. Not all. Us as theologians were not alone in emphasizing that God could suffer and does suffer with us, but still it was at the edge of things. Today it has become almost commonplace. I rejoice in this. How much process theology has had to do with it, I don't know. You see, you can get it from Bonhoeffer. I think that Moltmann gets it from other sources. There was a Japanese theologian who wrote a book on the pain of God. There are many sources, and I'm not at all saying this is because of the work of process theology that this has become a commonplace. I think basically it's because it's the teaching of the Bible. And every now and again, Christians do pay some attention to that book. Of course, many Christians talk a lot about that book, but it's astonishing how the biblicists maintain so many doctrines that are not in the Bible. Now, this is one point at which it's not only in what we might call the old line churches that we have seen a shift but also among conservative evangelical. Now there, these issues are still heatedly debated, but I'm going to be referring several times to the fact that there is a, I think, quite significant development in conservative evangelical circles in this country that is called open theology. Clark Pinnock is the leader of this community, and he was at one time very far to the right and would have held to all the doctrines that I'm criticizing. But he and others in this movement have taken the Bible seriously and have also, I think, taken Christian piety seriously. And on the topic I'm now discussing, Mark Pinnock would take virtually the identical position that I'm describing. But this is, from my point of view, a cause for rejoicing that a stream of thought, I mean, process theology, certainly comes out of the liberal wing of Christian thought, Protestant thought. This comes out of the conservative wing. But we find out we agree. I'm going to indicate we don't agree on everything, even on the topics I'm speaking of, but that God is vulnerable rather than invulnerable, that what we do makes a difference to God, that terrible things happening in human history involve God's suffering as well as human suffering. On all of these matters, I think we've made a lot of progress in the past decades. And as a process theologian, I celebrate that. We don't have to fight that battle particularly anymore. Now, a second issue is one that is, in fact, closely related to that one. And this is a second topic on which, whereas when I was studying, people who took the position I'm going to be describing were sort of far out on one side. Now it's become a very widespread view. And this is, the term I'm going to use here is panentheism. Many of the theologians today use that term. We have, but of course not everyone means exactly the same thing by it. I will be explaining it in rather general terms. I think that the process formulation is the most rigorous and adequate, but I'm not going to go very far into distinguishing that from other forms of panentheism. Now, in the history of the church, often the debate was between pantheism and theism. Pantheism is the view that God and the universe are identical. And if you are a pantheist, you may be either a very, what shall I say, spiritual pantheist who believes that all things really are divine and therefore quite different from the way in which the secular mind perceives them. So we are trying to probe through to the deeper truth about all things. There are other people who are pantheists, and they just mean, we'll just say whatever there is, all of it adds up together, and we'll call that God. I'd call that a kind of secular pantheism. It's much more reducing God to the universe rather than seeing the universe in its totality as truly divine. But either one of those can be properly called pantheism. Pantheism has been viewed in the history of the church as a dangerous tendency and a heresy when it is fully carried out. And process theologians agree. We don't like pantheism either. But unfortunately, in the rejection of pantheism, the official theologies of the church have emphasized God's transcendence in a sense that seems to mean God is external to the world. Some of you are old enough to remember that a bishop in England, John A.T. Robinson, once wrote a book, and he said, in the common perception, God is up there and out there. And of course, a lot of the rhetoric, even in our regular liturgies in the church, suggests we want God to come down to us. It implies that the place where God really is somewhere else. We want God to come to us. Now, this notion that God is fundamentally external to the world is, I think, not biblical, and I think does not express certainly the doctrine of incarnation and its implications. Fortunately, there have been many features of Christianity that cut in another way. The whole sacramental tradition has cut in another way. So I don't want it all to sound as though I think the whole of Christianity in the past has thought of God primarily as up there and out there, but it is amazing how much of the language that we use and other indications suggest that that's the image that gets projected and sometimes gets formulated rather rigidly. In the effort to avoid pantheism, God is separated from the world. We end up with something more like classical deism of the 18th century than the theism that I believe is the deeper meaning of Christianity. So, the alternative that has come to be widely accepted in one form or another is that God is everywhere, and that certainly is everywhere that everything else is. And that means that God is both transcendent in the sense of being something more than just adding together the things that otherwise exist, but that God is also immanent. So the doctrine that God is both transcendent and immanent, I think, is the Orthodox tradition, but in the Orthodox tradition, the transcendence has been so emphasized and the imagery has so encouraged it that it's necessary to argue for change in the ways in which it has been formulated and is being formulated. Well, the meaning of panentheism, strictly speaking, is that everything is in God. So you've got the pan of pantheism, but instead of saying everything put together is God, you say all the things that are not God are also in God. And that's a doctrine that, again, today is affirmed by many, many theologians coming from a variety of different traditions. And I rejoice, and that is a position which I think Clark Pinnock has, and the open theologians have no problem with. So we're still staying together with a community that has derived this from the Bible. There's one biblical verse that quite explicitly makes the point. And that's always nice to have. I don't think you can say because there's one verse that makes a point, that is the biblical doctrine. There's really no such thing as the biblical doctrine. The Bible is written by many, many people over many, many centuries, and there is great diversity. But I'm referring to the passage in Acts where it says, in God we live and move and have our being. John, for those of you who are Methodists, I'll mention John Wesley preached on that text, and what he came out with, though he didn't have the word panentheism, was definitely a panentheistic doctrine. So I hope you understand pantheism, everything put together is God. Panentheism, everything is in God, but to be in God doesn't mean that it constitutes the totality of God. God is more than the world, and of course is the unity of the world and the integration of the world, as well as having elements or features that transcend whatever the world might contribute to God. Now this is, the word panentheism does not explicitly assert that God is in everything. Nevertheless, virtually all panentheists move both ways on this doctrine. In any case, certainly process thought does. Everything is in God, and God is in everything. Now, of course, the most important part of that initially is that God is in us, so that we know God as God works within us, perhaps more clearly and vividly than we know God as God works in others. But obviously it's extremely important not to suppose that God works only in you. And we have learned in recent times, especially, it's extremely important that we not think God works only in human beings. Everything, including the animals, in God, and God is in everything, including the animals, but also, of course, the most minute elements of the physical world. Okay, so far I've simply been making the point that God is affected by what takes place in the world, that everything that is in God, and that God is in everything that is. I think this comes closer to making sense of a much wider range of biblical passages than the traditional tendencies. Now, one of the things I will point out here, we'll come back to it in a more thorough way a little later, is that if God is in everything, but is not everything, you understand, the things God is in are not God. The things God is in are the creatures. Then God does not act on things from without. God acts on things from within. And when we come to the topic that I will spend the most time on, unless I waste too much of my time earlier, about divine power, this becomes an extremely important point. Well, I'll move on very quickly to the doctrine of omnipotence, and then what time is left, we'll talk about omniscience, and then we'll talk about omnipotence. On the doctrine of omniscience also, I'm very pleased to say that the open theologians, who at least claim to get their ideas from the Bible rather than from a philosophy, take the same position that process theologians do. That is, yes, God is omniscient. God knows everything that is to be known, but there is much about the future that cannot be known because it doesn't exist, and what it will be is not yet decided. So God does not know the consequences of decisions that have not yet been made. Now, I think that's an easy translation of omniscience. I don't have any trouble with that. To know everything doesn't mean to know, it means to know what is definite and settled as definite and settled, and what is indefinite and unsettled as indefinite and unsettled. To know what has not yet been decided as if it had been decided would not be knowledge at all. It would simply be a form of error. And to attribute that form of error to God is not really to glorify God. So I'm going to let that one go very quickly. God is omniscient. The future is open. God's knowledge does not entail that the future is already settled in some way by God. Now, let me then spend the rest of the time on the doctrine of omnipotence. I'm doing that because I believe the doctrine of omnipotence is the single most harmful doctrine that has pervaded the Christian church. My professor, Charles Hartshorne, wrote a little book, and I recommend it to you. It's his one really popular book. Everybody can read it. It's called Omnipotence and Other Theological Mistakes. Now, to say omnipotence is a mistake, we'll start just in terms of what it means. I mean, the sense of it. What does omnipotence mean? It means, strictly speaking, all-powerful, having all the power. If God has all the power, then there is no power for anything else to have. Now, if you strictly go with that, I'm going to be attributing to those who hold to the doctrine of omnipotence positions that they will all squirm around. But they do squirm around them, and that's what I'm objecting to. I think we should tackle the problem directly and fundamentally and not just make paradoxes out of it. If God has all the power, then of course we have no power. If God, in the process of bringing creatures into existence, ceases to have all the power, then we need to say something. Then we could have some power. But if God has all the power, that also means that you can read the will of God off of what happens in the world. Now that's one of the places where I think the doctrine of omnipotence has horrible consequences. We will have to say God not merely willed but caused the Shoah, what we often call the Holocaust. But that's only one of many, many horrors of history which we must attribute to God if we seriously affirm divine omnipotence. Those who have affirmed divine omnipotence, as I say, they have to find some way to avoid simply putting all the blame on God. You see, if every time you commit a sin, actually God is causing that, then who is sinning? The logic is that God is sinning. But most of the same people who affirm divine omnipotence want you to suffer for your sins. And it seems a little nasty of God first to commit the sin and then make you suffer for it. And to think that this is a biblical doctrine is stretching matters. Now, I'm not saying you can't find some things in the Bible and put them together in ways that you could draw conclusions like this. But frankly, if I thought that were the biblical doctrine, I would say, well, so much worse for the Bible on that point. But I don't think I have to do that. And I'm going to, there are other just, I think, absurdities about the doctrine of omnipotence that I could spend time on. But since I said I was going to work biblically today, I'm going to go directly to the question, is the doctrine of divine omnipotence biblical? Now, in the first place, I do not want to deny that there are biblical verses which emphasize or assume that God is in control and that whatever God wants to happen is exactly what's going to happen. I'm sure there were biblical writers who thought in those terms. On the other hand, there is far more in the Bible which suggests that God calls somebody to do something, and then that person may or may not do what God has called that person to do. The story of Jonah is an interesting one because it certainly has elements of divine control in it. But when Jonah said no and got on a ship going the opposite direction from Nineveh, it doesn't say God put Jonah on that ship and made it go. It sounds like that was Jonah's free response. Okay, now, that doesn't mean God can't do anything about it any longer in this case. But we don't have God snatching Jonah off the ship and plumping him down in Nineveh. No, what God does is to kick up a storm. And then it's the sailors who throw Jonah into the sea. Now again, God does something. God brings a whale. So there's interaction. But you see, this is different from the notion that God does everything and causes everything. I think if Jonah had obeyed God the first time and gone to Nineveh, it would be too bad we wouldn't have this story about the whale. And we would be impoverished thereby. But anyway, it's an indication that the writer just doesn't think in terms of God being the sole actor. God acts, human beings act, the results come out of the interaction of what God does and what human beings do. Now, in my opinion, if you go on and come to the later writings, both within the Jewish scriptures and then certainly in the Christian scriptures, there's less and less of this sense of God acting unilaterally and more sense of God acting within us and through us. If we had lots of time, we could take the book of Romans, or we could take one of the Gospels and go through it and see how it is that God is acting. A lot of God's actions in the Gospels are through Jesus. And God also acts, I think, through the faith of those who come to Jesus for healing. But Jesus does something, says something, in order to effect the healing. The means are genuinely important in these accounts. Now, I'm rushing these matters because I do want to make a point which I'm astonished it's not more talked about than it is by biblical scholars. One of the main reasons that the great majority of English language, and the same would be true of German language and French language, people believing that God is the Almighty, has to do with the translation out of which we read. If you read in English, in almost all translations, the books of Genesis, Exodus, and Job especially, you will find again and again the term the Almighty or God Almighty. And we'd say, well, if the writers of the Bible repeatedly referred to God as the Almighty or God Almighty, they certainly believed God was omnipotent. And I would say, well, that would certainly weaken my position. But fortunately for my position, the Hebrew provides no justification for this language in our English translation. The Hebrew, and if you read your Revised Standard Version or New Revised Standard Version, look up the footnotes, you'll find out they acknowledge this. Whenever you come across God Almighty, the Hebrew text read El Shaddai. That's a proper name for God. El means God. Sometimes the Hebrew text simply reads Shaddai, and there the English translation says the Almighty. Now, no scholar whom I know would say there is anything about that proper name for God which suggests omnipotence or almightiness. The first time I was asking a scholar, happened to be a Jewish scholar, said, well, if you want to go be more faithful to the name and say what it seems to mean, you might say the breasted one. Now, others have said, well, that's going a little far. Now, last week we were in Wyoming at the Tetons, and I'm sure you know this is French for the tits. And other scholars have said that's probably the way, I mean, it has some connotation of the woman's breasts, but it also has some connotations of mountains. So probably the Tetons would be the best translation. But whichever way you go, I don't want to press it. No one, so far as I know, claims that the Hebrew has any suggestion of almightiness or omnipotence. Now, how did it get from a proper name, Shaddai, to the Almighty in our English? First step was in the Greek translation, the Septuagint, and in the Septuagint, in Job, you do come more than any other book in the Bible to something close to divine omnipotence. I mean, there are passages which move strongly in that direction, although even there, I mean, of course, God works through Satan and so forth. I mean, it's not really a straight doctrine of divine omnipotence. But that the Greek translators would have said, well, we don't want to use a proper name for God. You understand, if you use Yahweh sometimes and Shaddai other times, it's hard to say this is very monotheistic sounding. And so they wanted to do away with that kind of proper name. Okay, what do you do? Well, in Job, they said, why don't we use Kosmokrator? Now, Kosmokrator means ruler of the cosmos. And I think in Job, you could certainly say God is the ruler of the cosmos. So I'm not criticizing that. But in other places, in Genesis and Exodus, they use a variety of other replacements of the proper name by common name. But now the next step, that the Septuagint used in Job and use it consistently throughout. So now every time that Shaddai appears in our English, because we've all followed the Latin, it's amazing how slavish translators can be. So we've all following the Latin in English, we always find the Almighty or God Almighty. And as you probably know, the most common substitute for the word God in the English language is the Almighty. And the most common adjective associated with God in our liturgies is Almighty. How many prayers we address to Almighty God. Now, in my opinion, this has done and is doing to this day immense harm. And I'll just indicate a few of the ways in which I think that it has done harm. First of all, it makes the problem of evil insoluble. If God is Almighty, I mean, I know all the tricks that are played, but basically, if God has all the power, or even if you just say, God may not have all the power, but God overrules everything else, so God decides what's going to happen. It comes very close to the same thing. If God is in control of everything, then God does do terribly evil things. Now, I know people who accept that. They say God is neither good nor bad, equally good or bad. I don't find that to be a biblical doctrine, and I certainly don't find it to be what is revealed in Jesus Christ. It is not what is asserted in Paul. So it's, if you can find it in the Bible, it's at the extreme periphery. But in order to simply accept this doctrine of divine omnipotence, some people are willing to draw that kind of conclusion about God. So that means, practically speaking, I mean, the problem of evil is a practical problem as well as a theoretical one. Practically speaking, if your child is run over by a car, the question that comes to you and certainly to others is, why did God do that, or why did God let that happen? More people probably have given up on Christianity because they simply do not want to worship the God who does these terrible things than for any other one reason. They don't give up. I mean, the theoretical issue may be important, but it's much, much deeper than the theoretical issue. Well, one of the common answers in the past century or so, and I don't know when it first came into play, but it's become very widespread, is that God has all the power, but God has chosen not to exercise that power. So God gives us, makes a space and gives us freedom, and then lets us run the show. Now, I have two rather strong objections to that as a solution. And now I'm arguing against what is the majority solution. It is the position that the open theologians take. One objection is that if God could intervene to prevent historical horrors that last sometimes for centuries and chooses not to, you have to ask why. You can say, with respect to individuals' problems, you can say, well, it's so important for us to be free and responsible that it's not a good idea for God to intervene too much. But if God allows His chosen people to be virtually wiped off the face of the earth, you wonder, what would it take to get God to do something? And maybe the answer is there's nothing that would make God do anything. In that case, we really have an absentee God in a rather extreme sense. So I think that the net result with respect to the understanding of God and the world is a negative one in that respect. And secondly, it tends so strongly, and I've already suggested this, to imply that the kind of power that God has is a coercive, external, controlling power. Now, from the point of view of process thought, as I mentioned before, God's power works in us internally, works in all creatures internally. No event is the result of any single cause. For process thinkers, there are many causes involved in everything that takes place. God is one of those causes. And what God works to do is to empower us, to liberate us, to strengthen us, to teach us, to guide us, to direct us. But how we respond to all of those nudges and pulls and promptings is finally what we do. Now, I think that a great deal of what we find in the Bible fits that understanding. God calls and we respond. God never gives up on us. But of course, some of the things that might have happened if we had responded well and fully the first time can't ever happen. So the fact that God gives up on us doesn't mean, well, we can just relax and wait. Later on, just before we die, we'll say yes. Every negative decision has permanent consequences, but there are always new possibilities arising in the new moment. Now, is that biblical? I think so. But you understand, I'm not saying that is the only way in which any biblical writer thought of matters. I am saying I believe that in the development of the thought that we find in the Jewish scriptures and in the Gospels and in Paul, that the thought goes more and more deeply in this direction. Paul talks about Spirit in us and Christ in us, and these are the saving realities. Paul really believed that entities, that realities, can be internal to one another. We are even members one of another. Well, for process thought, that's an insight that needs to be universally generalized. We are all in one another, and everything is in us. We do not exist as isolated, self-contained individuals. God does not exist as an individual, self-contained individual. We are all members one of another, and God is working in and through all of us. And whatever we do, whatever the results of our action, that also becomes part of the experience of God. Thank you.